I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, future warfare with soldiers on the ground hooked up to wireless remote controls, rockets that can change direction mid-flight and hit a moving target 24 miles away. But who's going to pay for all of this? Speaking of which, inflation, stagflation, recession, these are some of the economic terms being bandied about this week as retailers enter their final push before Christmas. Lackluster holiday shopping combined with the worst housing slump in 16 years, rising energy and food prices have all led to concerns that a recession isn't far away. The president today said while there are challenges, the economy has been growing for 6 years. There have been 51 months of job growth and productivity is high. He also issued a warning to Congress on taxes.
If you want to figure out a way to slow this economy down, just start taking money out of people's pockets or making it harder for small businesses to grow and invest. So one thing I want to share with you today is I'll veto any tax increase.
Well, joining us with more, Mark Zandi, chief economist at moodyseconomy.com. And Mark, first of all, just help us with what seems to be a disconnect. Maybe not. We hear people like Harvard economist Martin Feldstein saying that the U.S. could easily slip into recession, you know, several periods of no growth. And then we have the president saying there's been, you know, years of growth. Is there a disconnect?
No, the president's backward-looking. He's right. Over the past 6 years, the economy has expanded, and we've not experienced a month of job declines during that period. But Professor Feldstein, is looking forward, and he's saying, well, yes, we've done well up to now, but there are significant risks that the economy is going to slip away into recession in the coming quarters.
Well, help us with this, first of all, with your definition of recession or stagflation. What's the difference?
Recession is a broad-based persistent decline in economic activity. Generally, it coincides with slower inflation because the economy is weak and it makes it difficult for retailers to pass along price increases. Stagflation is a period of either weak economic growth or a recession combined with higher inflation, accelerating inflation. It's kind of the environment that we suffered through in the 1970s, early 1980s.
Right. Well, retailers are saying that sales are down compared to last year. Online sales are up, but not as much as expected. So what is the retail picture and how big of an impact is that, as we look forward, not back?
Well, retailing is soft. Christmas is lining up to be just okay, certainly not as good as last year or the year before. And I do think retailers are very nervous post-Christmas. All the supports to consumer spending are weakening. Gasoline prices are up. House prices are down. Job market is softer. Stock market's up, down all around, but going nowhere fast. So I think there's a lot of nervousness on the part of retailers that consumers are going to pull back as we make our way into next year. And, of course, that would be necessary for a recession or stagflation.
So what's your take on the president's speech today? Was he overly cheery?
Yeah, he was overly optimistic, but that's his job. You know, confidence is flagging, and it all can become self-reinforcing, and he's trying to boost confidence to jumpstart the confidence in the economy. So he's doing the right thing. But I do think the fundamentals are very weak and the risks are very high, and if policymakers aren't more aggressive, if we don't see the Federal Reserve stepping in with more rate cuts, then I do think odds of recession are quite high.
Well, I was going to ask you about what you think needs to happen. I mean, the president, of course, is holding the line on any tax increases, but you just mentioned rate cuts. What do you think the president or the government in general can do, including that?
Well, I do think we need more rate cuts. The Federal Reserve is going to lower rates. I'm fairly confident they're going to be. It's going to be necessary for them to do that. I don't think tax increases, certainly not now, certainly not in 2008, would be wise. That would hurt the economy at this point in time. It doesn't say anything about tax increases in the future to help our fiscal problems longer term, but in the very immediate future, that's certainly not advisable. And I do think the administration and Congress need to provide more help to very hard-pressed homeowners that are going to lose their home in foreclosure, not so much to bail them out, but to bail ourselves out, because if they don't get any help, house prices will fall further, the housing market will evaporate, and the risk is that we do fall into recession.
Yeah. Briefly, the Bloomberg News writes today about concerns that the world economy is facing a double threat of both recession and inflation. Just some signs from the world economy.
Yeah, that is an issue. Up till now, the global economy has been performing very well, and that's been supporting our growth here. The trade deficit's been narrowing because of that strong growth overseas. But there are cracks in the global facade. The Canadian economy is struggling. The U.K., the Europeans are starting to cut interest rates. So that bears very close watching. If the global economy starts to weaken, we've got a problem.
Okay. Mark Zandi, chief economist at moodyseconomy.com, on the latest economic news and also looking ahead at the future. Mark, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, the president also again today said that Congress must pass a budget bill that funds the troops in Iraq with no strings attached. But who's going to pay for a new Army modernization program that's got a price tag of $200 billion? Critics say it's too expensive and behind schedule, but supporters, and we're about to speak to one, says it's imperative to save lives. It's called Future Combat Systems, robots and drones that hover like flying saucers between buildings, missiles that can change direction on the way to their target 24 miles away, all connected by a wireless network to soldiers on the battlefield. It's combat by mouse click. To some extent, it is generational because young soldiers who grew up playing video games are making suggestions that are affecting the designs of some of these new weapons systems. Reporter Alec Klein is covering the Future Combat Systems program for The Washington Post. He joins us from Washington. We're also joined by retired Major General Robert Scales. He's been involved with this program since the mid-90s. In fact, he's given credit for being the visionary behind it. He's been with us before. So, General, we want to welcome you back and ask, is this what you had in mind, you know, new weapons like the box of rockets controlled by remote control, when you were asked to look into the future?
Exactly. In fact, our vision was that precision takes the place of mass. And, of course, what we've seen in Afghanistan and Iraq lately, that idea has really sort of come home to roost.
Well, you know, we want to talk about the technology, these things that soldiers are calling beer kegs and some of the other items that are being talked about. But since you raised that, General, let's just get one of the biggest criticisms out right out front. In Iraq in particular, we're seeing something else that's really seeming to work right now. It's the surge in Iraq. More boots on the ground. This isn't about high technology. It's about just the presence of troops. So there seems to be some sort of disconnect there.
No, there's no disconnect at all. In fact, one of the tenets of FCS is a greater density of infantry and the ability to use technology rather than people. 52% of all the casualties this nation has suffered in the last 50 years have been suffered trying to find the enemy. So if we can find the enemy with surrogates and engage him with something other than people, that will save lives, an enormous number of lives.
Alec, it sounds like you wanted to jump in there, so go right ahead.
One of the principles of future combat systems is that machine supplants man. There's a sense of distance, if you will, to protect the soldier as much as possible through robots, drones, boxes of rockets, what have you.
Well, let's talk about some of that technology that you say is designed to protect soldiers and let some of these machines do some of that more dangerous work. There's the ground vehicles that can be remotely controlled to explore caves and tunnels and sewers. They look like a kid's big wheel vehicle, you know. And then there's these unmanned aerial vehicles. Soldiers are calling these the beer kegs. Alec, what's that?
I think you're referring to one of the unmanned aerial vehicles, which already an early version is being used in battle in Iraq. According to the Army, it has been successful in helping to identify IEDs or improvised explosive devices. And the soldiers like it so much, apparently, that they've nicknamed it because of the way it looks. It's sort of this cylinder on legs, and it weighs 30 pounds and looks a bit like a flying saucer in the way that it hovers in the air between buildings looking for the bad guy.
Well, and General, we understand the soldiers are going to be connected to this FCS wireless network to run some of these devices. They're going to carry, remote controls and things to direct these air and ground robots. Your thoughts on that?
Well, it's interesting because when we started on this in 95, the Internet was virtually unknown. Back in those days, our vision was to build an army that had 21st century, what we learned to call situational awareness, or the ability to see. And what FCS offers is this network, so that a soldier on the ground can literally call down a streaming video image of, say, the enemy a few meters or a few kilometers away and be able to anticipate where he is. So if a soldier can reach up into the network, see the enemy, actually watch him moving around the battlefield, and before he engages him, that would enormously decrease the cost of land warfare. When I was in Iraq a few weeks ago, I saw this in play out in action with the 4th of the 9th Infantry. The unit is sort of a proto, if you will, or a primitive version of FCS with this equipment that Alec is talking about, that's being some of it being distributed to them. Mm-hmm. And the young soldiers had what was called an Apollo 13 moment, where commanders threw out on the table bits and pieces of this new equipment and asked the soldiers to pick it up and, if you will, sort of play with it in battle. And the results have been extraordinary. And many of the conceptual ideas that we came up in the mid-90s are now being actually played out on the battlefield as primitive bits and pieces of FCS begin to make their way into Iraq. Young soldiers, the Xbox generation, are picking this stuff up and actually applying it in combat in a way that my generation never would have thought of, say, 10 or 15 years ago. The surest proof of whether or not this stuff works isn't the laboratory or the scientists. It's the ability to put it in the hands of young soldiers and let them play with it.
So, General, you are envisioning something that, in fact, is something that now these young soldiers are completely familiar with. But a couple questions about that. First of all, we're reading that, and I'm not sure if this is your program, but there's a story about a former cop and an EMS paramedic who are helping to develop an anti-terror device that would thwart, roadside bombings, and they're working on a system to disable suicide bombs as well. It blocks the cell phone or radio-controlled signal from reaching a device. Is this technology that can be blocked?
You can never rest on your laurels and say that one particular technology is going to solve all your problems, because enemies are adaptive and they know how to take you on with technologies. But that shouldn't remove our obligation to apply technology as much as we can to keep young soldiers alive.
Alec.
One of the concerns is that what happens if the network is disrupted? What happens if, essentially, if you will, the computer crashes? Those who are putting together future combat systems say that they have backups in place to ensure that the soldiers are protected in such a calamity, but it's at least a concern that's been raised.
You write you had an online chat with Washington Post readers, and one of them said just that. I watch TV, I play video games, I read Tom Clancy's books. I think I can think of ways that this plan can be defeated.
We're talking about the use of satellites, which are under development. We're talking about essentially an internet backbone that is under development. We're talking about all kinds of other complementary technologies that are under development by the military to make this a truly networked, wireless, seamless system where, say, a tank going 40 miles an hour in the middle of battle in the desert can, download video on the go. It's a very complex technology, and there's been some questions about whether some of these technologies should have been more mature before they launched the program.
That's Washington Post reporter Alec Klein talking about the Army's Future Combat Systems Project, a $200 billion price tag on it, and the Government Accountability Office says it's 4 years behind schedule. Well, we're also speaking with retired Major General Robert Scales, who was sort of the visionary behind the thinking in the program. When we come back, we'll ask him, will this new reliance on technology change the way soldiers think, maybe make them more vulnerable in the field? And later in the program, we'll be out on the campaign trail in Iowa. We'll have that as well. Back in 1 minute, here and now. We're back with more from Washington Post reporter Alec Klein and retired Army General Robert Scales. We've been talking about the Army's $200 billion future combat systems project, some of it already in use in Iraq. Robots, sensors, and drones all connected to a wireless network to allow soldiers to collect information about the enemy and attack them in a safer way before having to engage them face-to-face. General Scales, you dismiss some of the critics, but they include people who say there's something unethical about soldiers having distance from danger, not being aware of the consequences of launching a weapon, for instance. And they say war is not a game, should not be seen as a video game. You say the technology will save lives. Other critics say the cost of the program will take away from other necessary expenses like body armor. You say it won't. But let's ask you, if we may, to address another criticism, that this high technology takes the fight out of a soldier so that when they are face-to-face with an enemy, they're caught flat-footed because they've been depending too much on technology.
Well, one of the things we've learned in Iraq and Afghanistan is the immutable nature of war. We've learned that no matter how much technology you throw at the close battle, the enemy will always adapt, and he'll always find ways to draw you in, to hug you, if you will, to be able to engage our young infantry soldiers close. And so if anything, what FCS does is enhance or to improve the ability of the infantry to gain an advantage. But here's the problem. Mm-hmm. The problem is, for wars over the last 50 years, when you get close to the enemy, it's always been a fair fight. It's always been a fight between an enemy soldier and an American soldier. And what we say in FCS is, America can't afford to fight fair anymore. What we have to do is find every advantage, human and technological, that we can to reduce the cost of close combat. Because the enemy knows that when he takes us on, the object isn't to defeat us, but to avoid losing. And the surest way that he can win is simply just to kill Americans, not to achieve an end, but as an end in itself. So any technology we can apply to this close fight, to turn this from a fair fight into an unfair fight, is just what we have to do as a nation.
Again, you're saying that's because the U.S. is faced with suicide bombers, for instance, for pretty much the first time. Well, you also say what used to be effective isn't anymore. For instance, U.S. air attacks used to produce a higher ratio of enemy casualties to American casualties.
That's right. Just to give you an example, there's a thing called exchange ratios. In air-to-air combat, the exchange ratio for the Air Force F-15 fighters is 107-1. In recent battles in places like Fallujah, the exchange ratio is anywhere between a 6-1 and a 9-1. Well, that's just not that's not enough of a disparity for a country that has the technology to and the ability to apply technology to the battlefield. We've spent $1.34 trillion over the last 30 years or so buying fighter planes and systems to give us this huge exchange ratio. It's about time we took that technology and applied it to land warfare, where hopefully in the future we can take what is essentially a fair fight and make it an unfair fight.
Let's talk about money. Congressman Neil Abercrombie is one of the critics. He's a Democrat from Hawaii, chair of the House Air and Land Forces Subcommittee. He wonders, how can the Army afford to rebuild itself, which it has to do after two conflicts, and pay for FCS at the same time? Alec, what does the Army say?
Well, I think that's a very good question, and it's a question not only coming from that member of Congress, but from many others, including the Congressional Budget Office, which said in a study last year that in 2015, I believe, the Army will be spending about half of its procurement budget on future combat systems, leaving not a lot of money for other needs, improvements, so forth. When you talk to the Army, though, they say, look, the alternative is to do nothing, and that's not an alternative. And they're saying we need to modernize and that it needs to be done.
Well, General Scales, I want to come back to you as we wrap up. You described this aha moment back in the mid-90s when you conducted a series of war games that you say demonstrated to you the Army needed a lighter, faster force. But the criticism of former Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld was that he also called for a lighter, faster force in invading Iraq in 2003. To him, that meant less boots on the ground, against the advice of a top general. So what am I hearing? I mean, you're given credit for being the visionary who saw the need to modernize, to create the lighter, faster force. Did you mean less troops?
No. The mistake on Rumsfeld's part was this idea of fighting a war by substituting firepower for manpower. This is the so-called shock and awe approach, the precision strike approach to future warfare. And the mistake was that Rumsfeld misunderstood the enemy, that the enemy has always found ways to lessen the effect of firepower. He can hide, he can go to ground, he can hide in cities, he can mix among the population. And as the enemy tactic changes, that reduces the effectiveness of shock and awe and demands that this boots-on-the-ground approach, this infantry-centered approach, has to be applied. And unfortunately, what Rumsfeld thought at the time is that he could substitute one for the other. What we're realizing now is actually you need both.
It sounds like the misunderstanding was also that lighter and faster didn't mean less men or
exactly.
Women.
Exactly. Yeah. One of the implicit assumptions in the early days of the Rumsfeld era was that if we put money into precision strike, if we put money into firepower, then we can save in manpower. And what we've learned since then is no, it's about balance. Why? Well, because the enemy has a vote, and the enemy can find ways to lessen the effects of American killing power. So the only way to win in the future, we learned in the mid-90s, is a proper balance, a proper mix of our ability to apply shock and awe, but more important is the ability to put troops on the ground who are able to fight the close battle more effectively with a less cost in human life.
That's Robert Scales, retired Army Major General. We've also been speaking with Alec Klein, a reporter for The Washington Post, about the Army's future combat systems. For more, by the way, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Gentlemen, thank you both for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, tomorrow on Here and Now, the history behind that nutmeg in your eggnog and the toy test. An anxious father tries to figure out what's safe. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, the Brown family. How do five siblings not just get along, but get along while playing Rachmaninoff? That's all after the news, Here and Now. Fresh from winning the endorsement of the Des Moines Register and three New Hampshire papers, Republican presidential candidate John McCain won another high-profile nod today from former Democratic vice presidential candidate independent Joe Lieberman. On the Fox News Channel, Lieberman explained why.
John McCain, in my opinion, based on his record and all the work we've done together on keeping our military strong, on trying to stop the advance of global warming, on creating the 9/11 Commission, in all of those cases, I saw this guy rise above the negativeness, smallness, partisanship to get something done. So I'm really saying he's the best able to do that.
And Hillary Clinton, who won the Des Moines Register's Democratic Party endorsement yesterday, did not win the Boston Globe's nod here, just south of New Hampshire. That one went to Barack Obama. Mark Halperin is political analyst at Time Magazine and ABC News. He's on the campaign trail with Hillary Clinton today, helping us sort of take the temperature out on the trail. And Mark, starting with Clinton in Iowa, I can guess which of the two papers she is mentioning the most today.
Robin, she mentioned it yesterday in the western part of the state. Today, near Des Moines, she's talking about it, too. It's a great validator. You know, newspaper endorsements, I think, get overanalyzed by people like us on occasion. In this state, in that paper, it has a big following, and the editorial they wrote could have been written by the Clinton campaign, very much on message, comparing her experience and readiness for office and from their point of view with Barack Obama's. And so the Clinton campaign is very happy about it. It would have been a devastating blow. Some say, and I think it's not necessarily an overstatement, if they had endorsed Obama, it may have really tipped this decisively towards him. And so they're very happy, and she is talking about it quite a bit.
They did have praise for Obama, though.
They did. I mean, they're impressed by him and his ability to inspire. And you know, you talk to many people who work for Senator Clinton's campaign, and they will say if she weren't running, they would be inspired by Barack Obama too. They don't have any qualms with him. They're just trying to beat him. And so they're perfectly fine with the Register pointing out some good parts, but what they most liked, and this is where endorsements matter, it's the same with the Lieberman endorsement, it's not the identity of the endorser, I think, so much as what they say, how they validate what the campaign is trying to convey to voters. And the Register said, yes, there are things we like about Barack Obama, but on that decisive question that the Clinton campaign hopes and believes will decide this fight, they said she simply was more ready to be president right now than he is.
Well, and she tried to stay on that message on all six morning programs today. On the Today Show, though, David Gregory, who was hosting, didn't seem to want to let her. He pressed Hillary Clinton on Bill Clinton's comments, Clinton saying over the weekend that voting for Barack Obama is like rolling the dice on America's future. Hillary Clinton was asked by David Gregory repeatedly what Bill Clinton meant by that, but she kept pointing to her endorsement. Let's listen.
All right, so you're choosing not to answer that question. Let me ask you another issue that has to do.
Wait a minute. I am making the case for my candidacy.
Right, but it, like
I
your
am
husband,
very happy that
Senator
I have.
Clinton
I have
very
strong
clear
supporters,
statement.
And I have editorial support. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that voters will have to judge us, and that's what I welcome. I invite people to do that.
Mark Halperin, Hillary Clinton, you know, some might say, has every right to say I didn't say that. Someone else did. I want to talk about my endorsement. Others might say that this is maybe something of a recent pattern in the campaign, someone saying something and the rest of the campaign sort of stepping away from it?
Well, Robin, I think all candidates have tried to play this game of not being fully accountable for things that their surrogates say. In the case of Senator Clinton, it's a little trickier because her surrogate number one is the former president of the United States, who draws huge media spotlight and who of late has said some things that have been somewhat controversial. There's no question that his remarks on Friday night with Charlie Rose were much more critical of Senator Obama than Senator Clinton has been, and certainly than she wanted to be this morning when she wanted to talk about the Des Moines Register endorsement. I think that for the rest of the time in this race, and if she's president for the rest of the time in public life, Senator Clinton is going to have to deal with the implications of her husband, both good and bad. And in this case, she simply did not want to endorse or engage on what he had said, which, again, were some pretty direct comments about Barack Obama's readiness for office and kind of challenging people, which the Clinton campaign is doing, to try to wake up from their point of view and not vote for someone who they say is simply not ready to be president.
I want to turn to former Massachusetts Governor, Republican Mitt Romney. He's making headlines today for getting somewhat teary-eyed on Meet the Press yesterday when describing what he called his joy in 1978 upon hearing that the Mormon Church, to which he, of course, belongs, began allowing blacks into the priesthood. In that same interview, host Tim Russert really pressed Romney on abortion. Now, Romney had said in an emotional speech during his Senate campaign in the early 90s here in Massachusetts that a family member died from an illegal abortion. He was very passionate about that and said that's why his mother was always for choice. And on Sunday, Tim Russert raised that and, you know, really questioned Mitt Romney about his change of heart. Let's listen to a little.
So the governor, play that out. Some states would allow abortion,
right.
Others wouldn't.
Yes.
Go back to your relative.
Mm-hmm.
They cross the border into
right.
another state, mm-hmm. or they stay in their own state and have an illegal abortion. What would be the consequences? Would they be?
I'll get to the consequences.
Please.
I promise.
Please.
But I want to point out that the first step, in my view, is that Roe v. Wade be overturned.
I should point out that Mitt Romney had just said to Russert that he felt that the state should decide the issue now. And Russert, of course, pressing back and asking, you know, what about that relative of yours? Mark, your thoughts on that?
Well, Governor Romney has had three big problems that he's had to address throughout his campaign. One is this issue of flip-flops, of change of position, some of which he acknowledges and says people should welcome my willingness to learn and change. His Mormon faith, which some people have said will be a big barrier to getting elected, and there are clearly some Americans who have reservations about it. And then finally, this issue of whether he's human enough, whether people can see the humanity in him and appreciate his understanding of the human condition and the lives of working class Americans. All three of those challenges were on display yesterday from a very tough interviewer, Tim Russert, and it's sort of in the eye of the beholder. Those who think Mitt Romney is a cult member and a flip-flopper and a robot, I think, found plenty of evidence in their eyes during that appearance. And those who think that he is something quite different, I think, might have thought his performance was quite strong. And all I can say is he's not put any of those three questions to rest, and Tim Russert's interview reflects that.
Okay, well, we want to talk about John McCain, who just also got this terrific endorsement from the Des Moines Register. With Mike Huckabee's rise in the polls in Iowa and South Carolina and Rudy Giuliani's slip in the polls, what does this mean about John McCain? I mean, where is he taking support from? Because, you know, just a few weeks ago, political pundits were awaiting the death of the McCain campaign.
Well, I will pat myself on the back and said I never wrote the death obituary of the McCain campaign. I've always thought that he had a strong hand to play, despite the mismanagement of his campaign, where they spent all his money and went really far down in the polls. He still has fundamental problems to his candidacy, particularly on the issue of immigration, where he's badly out of step with his party. And yet, the four people he's competing against all have flaws too. Even Fred Thompson, who a lot of people have written off, picked up a very big endorsement here in Iowa today from Congressman King, who has got a large following throughout the state. And I think you can't write anybody off. The strengths of McCain, a year ago he was the front runner to not just be the nominee but the next president. He still has most of that strength, and he's bringing it forward. And the endorsement of Joe Lieberman is a big plus because, again, it validates his argument that he's ready to be president. That's what Joe Lieberman was saying today in New Hampshire.
Mark Halperin, editor-at-large and senior political analyst at Time Magazine, political analyst for ABC News as well. Mark, thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
Okay, we'll continue to check in with Mark as we go along. Okay, we're going to take... no, we're not. We're going to continue with the program. You're listening to Here and Now.
Thank you.
Imagine a pianist on the concert stage, hands floating along the keyboard, unleashing the magic of Brahms or Rachmaninoff or Gershwin. Now multiply that sound by 5. The five Browns, heard here with trumpeter Chris Bode, are 20-something siblings Ryan, Melody, Gregory, Deandra, and Desiree. They were born in Salt Lake City, Utah, trained at Juilliard, and perform and record together. Their first two CDs have topped the classical charts. They fill college auditoriums with screaming fans. They've now released their third recording, Browns in Blue, and all five Browns, direct from Oprah and 60 Minutes, now are here for Here and Now from KUER in Salt Lake. Welcome, everyone.
Hi.
Thanks for having us.
Do me a favor, just go around the room and introduce yourselves.
Oh, hi. This is Desiree. Mm-hmm.
I'm Deandra.
I'm Gregory.
I'm Melody.
And I'm Ryan. That was all in age order, actually.
Oh, good. So that's some way to keep you guys in track. You know, I'm a fan. So please accept this in the spirit it's intended. Ryan, I'll start with you. Do you ever get sick of each other?
No, not really. I mean, sometimes we have our bad days, especially in, like, the practice room. Sometimes we'll argue a little bit about, you know, things in the music, what we're going to do. But for the most part, we really do get along. We're really close in age, too, so we're, like, best friends. I think this wouldn't work if we weren't, you know, didn't get along.
Melody, I just heard it seemed the girls, the three of you, were sort of admonishing the guys because they hadn't started practicing something yet.
You were listening in on our conversation.
I was.
Yes, I was. We were, because Ryan likes to take long breaks around the holidays.
Spending too much time with my girlfriend. Yeah.
What, you mean your computer? Playing video games?
Well, you know, I wondered about that because practice, and as we speak, we'll hear some more of your gorgeous playing, but, you know, practice, and when you get on the stage, this is serious stuff. You know, these classical pieces are very refined. There's not a lot of room for, you know, someone to miss their cue, and, you know, I'm just wondering, is there ever, you know, on stage even a moment where someone shoots a glance at someone else, Deandra, why don't you take this one? And, you know, there's this sense of, hey, this is the trill you should have been rehearsing.
That's so funny that you call on me to answer this, because everyone's glaring at me right now, because I'm the one that, if something goes wrong, I'm the first to, like, look at somebody and be like, what are you doing? Why weren't you there? Or whatever. But, you know, I think we rehearse so much through the time that we're home that, you know, it does kind of limit those times on stage where you're not together or things aren't quite working out. But it does happen. I mean, we're human. Things happen.
Gregory, I wonder, when you say rehearse at home, how does this work? Do you have 5 piano rooms?
Yes, actually, we do. We have more than 5, actually. We have 5 of our own, which are dispersed in different rooms of the house. And then now that we're Steinway artists, which means Steinway sort of sponsors us, they've been so kind as to loan us 5 other pianos that we can put in one room in our basement. So the ping pong table left and the 5 pianos came in. That was kind of a sad day.
That's Gregory Brown of the Piano Playing Siblings, the 5 Browns. We're going to hear more from all of them and hear more from their new CD, Browns in Blue, after a minute break, Here and Now. We're We're back with more from the classical music sensations, the Five Browns, siblings Ryan, Melody, Gregory, Deandra, and Desiree. Their new CD is called Browns in Blue. And Desiree, we want to listen to more. We asked you guys to pick a piece that you could deconstruct while we listen. You picked the one selection that was a commissioned piece. It's John Novacek's Reflections on Shenandoah. So tell us how you approach this.
This piece was a little tricky for us putting together. It's pretty complicated. There's a lot of meter changes. There's a lot of layering of different textures. It's kind of cool because John really took advantage of the acoustic possibilities for five pianos. Like at the very beginning, there's a repeated F sharp that gets passed around between the five pianos. Each person gets one F sharp and then it repeats the cycle over and over. And so getting that to sound consistent was so tricky. And then at the end, the Shenandoah theme, he told us to envision the melody wafting over the river, echoing over the river. So it has a very cool, like, sound to it. This is Deanna, and then he's got some like New York rhythms and funk kind of thrown in there in the middle, so he kind of shakes it up a bit in the middle as well, which gives us, you know, something challenging as well.
There's a portion where it seems as if someone is sitting on their piano keys. It just kind of goes crazy. And I'm wondering, you know, anyone chime in on this. Classical can be, you know, it's restrictive. It's not jazz. Is this a moment where you can really let loose?
This is Gregory. Well, we hope that it sounds, I guess, like we're letting loose because there's so much chaos during that part. It's supposed to represent the city, and it took just hours and hours of rehearsal to get those so that we can be together because there's so many different tricky rhythms and all sorts of little jazz influences in there, and that was a real test for our ensemble. And so hopefully it sounds like we're just, you know, rocking out, but we're really stressing out.
I want to listen to Rachmaninoff's 18th variation on a theme from Paganini. It's such a familiar piano piece. And, you know, because pieces like this get familiar, sometimes they're caricatured, you know, and it becomes the cartoon of the classical piece. Here you are playing it in front of young people. You know, someone chime in. What's that like to, you know, you're young and people are hoping that you're going to bring more young people to classical music. What's that like to play before young people?
This is Desiree. It's really invigorating. They bring a different energy to a concert. They're much more vocal. They're used to expressing their excitement and their energy by cheering and clapping. And to be able to play such a standard piece, like, you know, the heart of the Rachmaninoff's Rhapsody on a Theme by Paganini, it's so cool to introduce this to an audience. We speak about the piece before we play and how it's about being in love, and everybody, you know, will experience that or has experienced that, and it's nice to share that with a new audience.
wondering, you know, there's five of you. You all seem to, this has become the company business. Thankfully, you all are so talented and no one had to get left out. But still, I'm wondering, as you've grown up and gone along with this, isn't there a time when you said, wait a minute, I wanted to be Bruce Hornsby, or there's something, you know, in me that's not getting expressed because it's, you know, at a certain point, it's sort of, we all have to walk in step. Does that ever happen?
Well, actually, we thought a lot about that because, you know, we wanted to make sure that playing as a group, it wasn't always just about the group. And so, actually, that's what's so nice is that we get to play our solos on the albums as well in the concerts. We get to have our individual voices. And so it's really the best of both worlds. We get to have our solo spot, and then we get to come together as a chamber ensemble. So we love it. And yeah, we'll keep on doing this until, you know, people don't want to hear us anymore.
Tell us a solo that we should play, Melody.
Maybe Gregory's
The Handy?
The transcription by, it's Art Tatum's transcription of Ann Hagar's Blues. That's a pretty much straight up jazz piece. Art Tatum was a really awesome improviser, and this is actually a transcription of one of his improvs back in the day, which is way, way cool.
And it's also credited to W.C. Handy.
Yes.
Yeah. By the way, you're all Mormon. I don't think it's at all necessary to ask about that. After all, you're not running for president or anything. but I'm wondering, is there anything about your Mormon upbringing that's informed your music?
This is Desiree. I think so. I feel like our family has such a spiritual side to us. And, you know, the spiritual bond or the bond of our faith bonds us even more than the music. And I think that definitely influences how we look at music, what we feel through the music, since that's such a big part of our life. So what we recall in our memories or what music sounds like to us, a lot of times that will come back to spiritual things in our life.
Well, and we know that Mormons believe not just in an afterlife, but one in which whole families like yours will be together in the afterlife. So
that's exactly right.
You could be doing this for a long time.
Hopefully so.
We're stuck with each other for a long time, guys.
We're speaking to the siblings and pianists, the Five Browns, Ryan, Melody, Gregory, Deandra, and Desiree. Their new CD is Browns in Blue. Thank you all so much for speaking to us.
Hey,
thanks
our
for
pleasure.
Having us.
You're like the Osmonds of classical music. Does everyone say that?
No, I don't know, sometimes. Oh, and that's a compliment.
Yeah, that's a compliment. I mean, families that can work together and can still be good friends,
it takes a lot of work. You know, we put a work into it and we get this out of it. We have good relationships and enjoy time with each other.
Yeah, but we always say that, you know, we're brothers and sisters first, so we care about each other first as that. And if somebody's unhappy, you know, we don't want to force them, so.
Well, good for you. Thanks again so much.
Hey, our
thanks
pleasure.
Again. Have a good day. Thank you.